I tried so hard to change the system from within healthcare. I tried to sit on every committee I could possibly sit on to scream loudly that things have to change for patients and families, that this isn't right. I tried to write articles. I tried to teach medical students, residents, already graduated doctors and nurses. Every 5 years, I felt like I was in Groundhog Day over and over and over and over again. The same thing. I sit at the same committee, the same thing happening, the same people saying same thing, same thing. And the needle wasn't moving. So that's when I pivoted to the public and decided that the greatest change can happen when we create a groundswell of public, just citizens, regular citizens. If patients and families demand a different type of interaction with the healthcare system, then change might be able to happen.
That was Dr. Samantha Winemaker, a Hamilton-based palliative care physician who is on a mission to change the way our healthcare system treats patients facing terminal illness. I first interviewed Sammy Winemaker in the spring of 2021 about the Waiting Room Revolution podcast she and a colleague started in support of patients and families on their illness journey. Since then, I've noticed that she has stepped even further into the role of revolutionary through her frequent posts on social media, in which she uses her strong and passionate voice to educate, empower, and advocate for change in our society's approach to palliative care. That's why I was eager to invite Sammy to be our featured guest in this, the third episode of the Spiel on Hamilton's Impact Makers series. Have a listen. Hi, Sammy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Wendy. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. I've actually wanted to speak to you for a very long time, and this was such a great excuse to do it. So, Sammy, I've been following you on social media for the last year or so. And I know that you're a palliative care physician who feels very passionate about reforming the system. I've listened to your wonderful podcast, The Waiting Room Revolution. You've been a guest at the Hamilton Jewish Federation J-Talk series talking about this subject. But what I've noticed the last few months is you've become super active on social media, more so than like when I first became aware of the work that you've been doing. So I'm curious a bit about your career trajectory and what motivated you recently to put yourself out there and become the activist that you are.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious too. To be perfectly honest with you, if you had asked me even just a year and a half ago, you know, if I thought I would be where I am right now in terms of utilizing social media, I would have said, you have got the wrong person, honestly. I have led a very private life, actually, for as long as I can remember. I've never even had any personal social media platforms. I haven't had a Facebook account. I think the only thing I've ever used is email. So it is really new business for me. And whatever pivot you're feeling, I'm feeling it too. It's new learning. And my head is about bursting with trying to figure out all of this technological stuff. But to answer your question, it started when I had a craving to go public with all the shortcomings that I was witnessing in healthcare. And I had an idea to write a book. And I met with someone in Toronto, very excited to say that I was going to do an expose so that everyone out there could understand that we've got a problem here and that there's opportunity to change. And he looked at me and he said, well, who are you? And I said, well, I'm Sammy Winemaker. I'm a palliative care physician. And these are my credentials. And, you know, it was sort of cute. He basically told me that without any kind of footprint, and I'm not famous, that it would be very difficult for me to convince someone that a book that's part memoir, part expose of Dr. Sammy Winemaker would probably be a tough sell. And so he encouraged me to build a network. And so I didn't know exactly what that meant, And I didn't feel like I had the time to do that because I felt that my messages were so important. I had to get them out as fast as possible. And I can explain that if you want. The long and the short of it is that I have two daughters. They are well-versed in social media and helped me understand the power and the magnitude and what I could do with social media much bigger and faster than any other avenue. And so where it became originally a way for me to create network and to position myself for a would-be book, I realized quite quickly that the social media itself gave me an important voice, and it became less to me about networking and more about having access to the public in a way that I was completely ignorant about. I knew nothing about what was happening in social media world. In fact, I was shocked. I was so shocked and had empathy actually for my girls having to grow up with such a huge presence of social media, the power of it in a positive and a negative way. But what you can do from an advocacy point of view is unreal. And it became like a daily journal for me almost. It was therapeutic for me to be able to shout out in social media all the things that were pent up inside of me, which is why I say to you yes all the time when you say, can you write an article? Yes. Can you be on this? Yes. Because I think I've been, it's been building inside of me. And I guess it just burst. It burst a year and a half ago onto social media. And so it's just bleeding from me now.
It's incredible because I see, you know, I'm on Instagram and I'm on Twitter and I see new content from you almost on a daily basis, which amazes me. Does that require a lot of your energy to do those posts?
It doesn't really. I don't know how to do graphics and things like that. So, but the content comes easy to me. It just flows. I have had huge amount of exposure to the trauma and the glory of people who are facing, you know, very life-changing illnesses, and it just flows. The content is easy. It's the figuring out the social media, the tone, the boundaries. I have lots of patient stories, but that's confidential, and yeah. So figuring out that piece of it is, you know, new learning for me. What people respond to and what they don't respond to. And also, of course, the content, a lot of it is about dying. And one of my main messages is that people need to be invited to know more about that very unique chapter in life. And here I am bursting out onto social media talking all about dying, which sort of contradicts the idea that people need to be invited to know more, but shouldn't be forced to know more. So I'm trying to figure out those kinds of fine lines. Where do we draw the line in the sand? And so it's been exciting for me because I feel like I've learned so much.
Well, what's the impact that you've had? Like, how many followers do you have on the various platforms that you're on? Do you have any idea?
Well, I've done no promotion. And so it's all been organic. I would say, you know, I mean, the most recent one is TikTok, and I'm understanding that you can grow a network faster on TikTok. But I think at this point, and I don't even know if this is impressive or not, so don't laugh. But I think I have over 30,000 followers on TikTok in the last, you know, 3 months.
Wow.
You know, you can get millions. So I think it is a spit in the wind, but I'm proud. And it's not, I don't even care. I don't care how many followers. I've met so many people. I have thousands of followers on Instagram and on Twitter. The communities on each of those platforms are very different. And, you know, I use each one of them in different ways. What can I say about the followers? I would say that to me, it's less about the numbers and it's more about the affirmation that I get from the comments that people make on my Instagram or in Twitter or TikTok, people saying, I'm so grateful that I found you. This has made such a big difference for me. Or I finally understand what happened last year. Or I have been traumatized by X, Y, or Z, and you've suddenly given me the missing piece. One by one, that's all I care about. I care less about the original focus of building this kingdom of followers or whatever, and more about if there's one person at a time that gets something from the content, I feel like that's a win. It's very important to me to be engaged with so-called followers and not just have followers. So it's affirming of my passion, and it feeds me and makes me want to do it more. It's not the followers and the numbers of followers. It's the affirmation and that you feel like you're making a difference. And people reach out to me behind the scenes, like on all these ways of messaging people and Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter, LinkedIn. And I've met incredible people. I've made incredible connections. I've been invited to something like this. Like, it's that stuff that's incredible. So it's a ripple effect. The social media is a voice. It's therapeutic. It's my daily rinsing. It's connections. It's affirming. It leads to the adjacent possible. I'm learning from the comments, the reactions that, and my own advocacy and focus of advocacy is growing from what originally it was about end-of-life care, palliative care, dying and death, to something much more about mortality awareness and becoming a patient, what it's like to be a patient in a very foreign system called the healthcare system, and that things can go quickly awry right from the diagnosis if people don't understand. It is a different culture, and being a patient is a different role than any other role people have had. And in order to remain intact and be the person at the end of their healthcare journey and recognize themselves, that change can happen at the beginning of a healthcare journey. So I'm moving from downstream, upstream, and I'm very interested in the beginning of becoming a patient, and that being an opportunity to influence your entire healthcare journey.
Wow. Those are very big goals. I'm curious about how much time out of your day is it taking for you to read all these comments, to interact with all these people who are reaching out to you as a result of your social media activity? And is it draining you? Is it sucking time out of your day? Because I imagine you must be a very busy physician as it is. I guess, how much of your time is this all taking up?
Well, I can look at my phone and tell you how much it tells me I'm on my phone, and it's pretty sad. I think it says I'm somewhere around, 5 or 6 hours a day, but that's, my work also is I use my phone for my work. But I try to discipline myself every morning, about 6:30 in the morning. I do wake up really early. I always have my entire life, so that's natural for me. And I used to read the newspaper, watch a little bit of the news, have my coffee. And now my daily ritual in the morning is to go on Instagram and to do my Twitter. And those are just quick bolus sound bites of issues that are on my mind, or that I've been exposed to the day before or the week before. And so I probably spend about just a half an hour in the morning creating my tweet and my Instagram post. My TikTok videos I do in bulk, because of course I have to look nice, and I have to put a little makeup on, wash my hair, put a couple of different tops on. I come into my living room here, set up my TikTok station, and off I go, taping probably 2 weeks worth at a time, and have someone helping me post them every day. So as long as I can tape them, so it takes a couple of hours every two weekends for me to do the TikTok posts, and then they got put out every night at 8 o'clock.
Who does that? Your daughters?
My daughters both have been very helpful. I have a colleague that I work with, a researcher. He's on a mission, same mission as I am, and he has a research team, and they've been good enough to help me with the graphics for the TikTok, and also to help with the posting of them. So I have some fringe help, I would say, volunteer.
But in terms of reading the comments, that your social media posts elicit. That's just you. You go through that?
Yeah, that's just me. I go through. Yeah. So, you know, I don't get them all and I can't read them all, but I get to most of them. You know, my goal is I just need to be good enough. I need to answer enough of them. I need to have a good enough message, good enough graphics, good enough. I'm not out there to win, you know, an award for the best social media advocate ever because of my graphics, or I just have a passion.
Well, one of the questions I was going to ask you, I think you've already answered, which is like, what is the outcome you want to have? What is driving all of this? What's the mission?
Yeah, I guess the mission is that people, citizens who become patients, have a fighting chance to create a person-centered illness journey so that when they meet someone like me at the end of life, they still feel intact. They can recognize themselves, even though they may have physically changed because of the illness, but that they still remain themselves. There are too many people who end up at the end of life feeling helpless, hopeless, worthless, that life is meaningless. They're scared and anxious. All of that amplifies their symptoms. And there is an unbelievable amount of people asking for assisted dying now that it's legal in Canada than you can ever imagine. Without any judgment about assisted dying, it scares me that people go through a serious illness journey and can end up feeling that way because they don't know what they don't know, and that the healthcare system is uncomfortable talking about the reality and the truth of the illness and helping people truly understand when they're moving through chapters of an illness, help patients and families feel woke and still hopeful while they move from the beginning to the middle to the end of an illness. There is a way to have quality of life and to have great meaning in life, even through a serious illness. But if we don't help people see that, then I don't blame people for wanting MAID, because they get to the end and they've been on a conveyor belt. And they don't recognize themselves and they're scared and they think that they're going to have crescendoing pain and then suddenly die. Well, who wouldn't want MAID, right? So I think one of the things that has catapulted me forward has been the legalization of assisted dying. Mm-hmm. I've seen way too many people who, once they understand their healthcare journey better, once they know where it's going, and how it's going to get there and what's available to them. Many people my entire career have said to me, oh, you know what? I don't think I need the gun anymore. I don't need the pillow over my face. I don't need the injection I've been asking you for. This is before it was even legal. People always asked us to kill them. But once we sat with their suffering and helped unpack where their angst was coming from, many of them said, oh, I never knew that. I didn't know. I can't believe it. And so now that MAID is legal, we need to make sure as many people as possible have a fighting chance to have an illness journey that is more meaningful.
Is this a spiritual practice, your activism?
I certainly feel a lot of passion. It's not religious. It must be spiritual, but I don't know what container that comes in.
Well, what I'm picking up is this: you've got such a strong desire to improve people's lives, especially the end of their lives. Like you keep using the phrase, you want people to be able to recognize themselves at the end of their life. So clearly, hearing you say that is that you've come across so many people who are not themselves, who do not feel like themselves. So, you know, I'm hearing a little bit of spirituality in there, because you so much want people to end their lives feeling whole, that they have value, that they're worthy, that they have love. Mm-hmm. It just sounds so spiritual when you say it like that.
Maybe it is.
So I'm curious about a little bit about your background, because one of the questions I had put down here was, when you look back on your life, what would you say are the roots of your community activism?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not sure that I have decades of community activism under my belt. I can't say that I've always been part of activism, let's just say. I really do believe it has been born out of my exposure to people in their homes, patients and their families and their suffering. And what I see is unnecessary suffering due to the healthcare system or due to our societal death-denying propensity, the fact that we, you know, value youth and physical prowess and beauty. Maybe it's my age. I'm 52 and I might be having a swan song or the next act, whatever it is. And I'm a woman who's learning from my two girls who are going through, you know, a lot of social activism, and the world is different for them than it was for me. And I think it's just a combination of all these stars aligning. And I have suddenly felt a huge fire within me. And it doesn't come from decades of community activism. It came as a perfect storm at the right place, at the right time, and with the right opportunities.
Yes, it makes sense. I mean, firstly, it's a very honest, authentic answer. I totally understand what you're saying. It was like you chose this profession and things unfolded the way they unfolded. You saw what you saw, and this became something that was so important for you. How long have you been a palliative care physician?
It's been about 19 years.
And what was it like for you at the beginning of your career? Did you feel this, like you say, this fire to change the system way back in the beginning?
Not really. Maybe a little bit. Maybe about a 2 out of 10, if I'm a 10 out of 10 now. I think at the beginning, I felt addicted to coming onto the scene when things were dire and other people had said to the patients and families, "I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do for you." And the only thing I could do is pull them up and make them feel better, help with their symptoms in a way that felt like heroism and heroin. It was addicting when you go in and you arrive on the scene and you make people feel better instantly when they're so desperate and they hug you and they thank you for coming. It is such a feel-good experience. And so at the beginning, I would say that that's what drove me. People saying, "Oh, you must be so special being a palliative care doctor. Oh, you must be an angel." And I knew I wasn't, like, but okay, sure, I'll take that if that's what you want to think. But no, I'm just, you know, doing my job. But the truth is that quickly turned dark to me. That kind of incredible feeling of helping people became horrific when I felt like I was at the end of a river in a cesspool, the river being healthcare, me being at the very end when people were spit out. And I was supposed to clean up for the healthcare system, stitch people back together when they had been broken apart into pieces of their body or an illness or a number or a bed referred to that way. And I was supposed to come in and provide person-centered, whole person care, quality of life, la, 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 what's important to you, you know, family-centered care. But they had already gone through the grinder. The poor patients and families didn't even know that it shouldn't have been that way. And the sad part was, is sometimes they were grateful for what they did get, like the scraps. And that's how I saw it. And I just felt like, no, this is not fair. This disgusts me. And suddenly my work disgusted me. And I wanted to run from it. And I tried so hard to change the system from within healthcare. I tried to sit on every committee I could possibly sit on to scream loudly that things have to change for patients and families, that this isn't right. I tried to write articles. I tried to teach medical students, residents, already graduated doctors and nurses. Every 5 years, I felt like I was in Groundhog Day over and over and over and over again. The same thing. I sit at the same committee, the same thing happening, the same people saying same thing. And then the needle wasn't moving. So that's when I pivoted to the public and decided that the greatest change can happen when we create a groundswell of public, just citizens, regular citizens. They can be fancy or not fancy, well-known or not well-known, from every culture, from every country. If patients and families demand a different type of interaction with the healthcare system, then change might be able to happen.
You've talked about your social media followers and the impact you feel you're having on the public. Do you have any sense of any kind of impact you're having on the healthcare system in the city?
I do. And that's been such a silver lining, because I thought I was going to be driven out of town, of course. I was waiting for the police to be on my front lawn, to be asked to resign from multiple positions and hospital appointments once I aired the dirty laundry. I've had more healthcare professionals thank me and, again, affirm the messages. I've had more healthcare providers say, you've actually given us a new language. The language that you're using with the public is so much more comfortable to us that I feel like I'm now invited to ask and to lean in to these difficult conversations and not have to worry about not having the answer to everything, that I truly can show up to my patients in a very human way. That's what we all are. Every single one of us is going to get something at some point. Only 10% of us will die suddenly. Most of us will get something and we'll end up being patients, and end up, even me as a doctor, I'll end up being a patient at some point. But the healthcare system has been welcoming of this in ways that I'm pretty surprised, actually. I'm very surprised and delighted and excited.
That's wonderful. Also, so affirming to, as a justification for putting yourself out there and following your urges and your passion and just trusting that it's going to be okay.
And I know I have work to do, Wendy, because, you know, I'm thinking of a TikTok post that I did on that dying is not always painful. It went viral in my world. Most of the people that responded were naysayers or non-believers or downright haters. You know, you are a crazy doctor that doesn't know what you're talking about. Of course, dying is painful and da 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 da. I couldn't believe the backlash I got. Another one of my posts went popular, I guess I would just say, when I talked about dementia and how people die with dementia and the fact that in the very end, people don't eat. And I won't go into any detail right now, but I got such backlash about how we starve people to death and that's not humane and we can't let people starve to death. And it's just like, I don't want to say ignorance in a bad way, like in a judgmental way, but I cannot believe what people don't know and what people don't understand. It makes me realize how confused and how uneducated on these topics the average person really is. And crazy, because all of us are going to get something at some point. And we can't pretend that we're not any longer, so that we end up in these situations, uneducated, ignorant, scared, and freaked out.
So when you get that kind of response, negative hate mail, what's the impact of that on you? How does that make you feel? And how does that make you want to respond?
I think, well, first of all, sadly, you get used to it. And then you reach out to other people and say, you know, what did I do? Is there something I should have done differently? And I ask myself that. I am a very reflective person. Is there some wording that I need to be careful about? And yes, that is true. I do have to be careful. And these sound bites are so short and these topics are so deep and complex. It's really hard to reduce them to just a few sentences or 30 seconds. The truth is that when it does happen, what my daughters have told me is, Mama, the haters will be haters. And you know what? Look at how many more followers you have. All these haters. That's great, Mama. You know, like, and the truth is that any activity is better than no activity. I would rather have the haters peppered in there and have less activity. It's important for me to know what people are thinking and feeling. It makes me think and create new content for people in different ways. And it's not about me. I don't take it personally. Thank goodness there's been very few people that say things like about you physically. Like I'm surprised actually, you know, people don't say things like that. It's more haters about the content.
Right. Right. Wow. It's just unbelievable what the whole world that you've opened up for yourself and are navigating. And I honestly give you so much credit because to me, from the outside, it just seems that not only are you doing such important work in the world, but you're incredibly brave to do it so publicly because of the passion you feel for this subject. And really, bottom line is you just want to help people.
Yeah, I guess, you know, thinking back to one of your previous questions about my life of community activism, which I've admitted is not been a life of community. I think I have had a life of stepping up and speaking out. And so that hasn't really come in community activism, but I do have chutzpah, I think, and it has gotten me into trouble, but I will confront and, you know, speak my mind. That's always been encouraged in my own family. I think if I could go back, maybe I could do things more tactfully in my life, but I have always had a voice for sure.
And aren't we so lucky that you have this voice and that you're using it for the good for this community? Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Wendy, thank you so much, because every time I get an opportunity to talk about my favorite subject, it is therapeutic for me. And I am so impressed with the work that you're doing and the invitations that you've passed along to me. You know, it's so wonderful to work with such a strong woman like yourself with such creativity. I think I have a lot to learn from you too. So thank you.
Thank you, Sammy. I hope to see you soon. And thanks again for joining us.
The Spiel on Hamilton podcast is made possible through the generosity of the Allen and Millie Gould Family Foundation. The Spiel on Hamilton is a production of the Hamilton Jewish News, hosted and produced by me, Wendy Schneider, and edited by Jennifer Howe of Executed Events. If you have any comments, questions, or stories you would like to hear on the show, please email wschneider@jewishhamilton.org. We would love to hear from you. Make sure to subscribe to the Spiel on Hamilton on your favorite podcast platform to learn more about this wonderful community.